Good morning, everybody. Nice. Good stuff. Everybody awake and alive and ready to go? I'm not seeing a whole lot of stampede attire. Yeah, I'm just kind of, I don't either. I was talking to Jeff on the way in and he said it's kind of like a non-stampede church here. You know, like we're the anti-stampeders. Well, whatever. I don't know what that's about. Anyway, well, welcome everybody. My name is Tom. I'm part of the teaching team here at Friends, and I get to teach once in a blue moon, and it's kind of nice when I get to. And today I was going to do a message actually on a short story by C.S. Lewis. If you get your hands on it, it's well worth getting. It's called Light. It's about 2.5 pages long. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. I was going to do a whole message around that, and then Jeff said to me afterwards, he said, that'll be the longest reading in the history of Friends Church, so I don't think it's a great idea. So anyway, that got put to the side. So this morning I want to share a message with you around the idea of living in the gap. And so it's called Living the Gap. And the title of this message, well, I'll tell you what, before I go there, let me tell you a parable from the Bible. You probably didn't know this one was in the Bible, but it's a parable of Jesus was golfing with his disciples. Okay. And he was golfing up in Scotland. Okay, got to go to Scotland. You got to do the accent so that you get the joke right. And he was playing at St. Andrews, and where they play golf, the home of golf, right? And he's playing with Peter and John, and the three of them are going off, they're teeing off, and they got a fourth member that was just thrown in with the three of them, and off they go. And I don't know if you knew this, but Jesus was left-handed when he played golf. Did you know that? It's right there in the Bible. So they go off and they play the first couple of holes, and then the third hole, Jesus is not doing too well, and so he hits the ball and it goes into a water hazard, and he walks up to the water hazard and he looks at the hazard, and the water's part, and he walks into the dry land, takes out his pitching wedge, and he hits a beautiful shot right onto the green. And Peter and John are going, oh, brother, you know. And so the next hole, same thing happens. And he hits the ball and it goes, and it's kind of a shallow water hazard. And Jesus walks on the water. The ball comes to the surface. And he hits the ball off the water, right onto the green. And the fourth guy that was with Peter and John, he says to them, he goes, who does this guy think he is? Jesus Christ? And they said, no, it is Jesus. He thinks he's Phil Mickelson. So the idea is that there's always a difference between who we are, right? So there's a purpose to this parable. There's a difference between who we are, like where we are in life now, and who we want to be, right? There's a gap that exists. There's a gap that exists between what I want in life and what I have. Right? And the gap is, I mean, the idea of a gap is, it's interesting. There's a gap in wages. There's a gap in your teeth. There's gaps in life. And the negative connotation of the gap, of that space between who I want to be and where I'm at. Now, in one sense, you could actually call that thirst. There's a desire that pushes you, motivates you, that wants you to fill in the gap, that gets us motivated in life to have the things that we want and to be the person that we would like to be, and that can create a little bit of a gap there. But here's the problem, and a good illustration of this would be there's a town in Ireland, Northern Ireland, and the name of the town historically was called Derry, D-E-R-R-Y. And there's a that's an interesting sign actually, because the official name today is Londonderry. But the unionists are the ones that call it Londonderry, and the nationalists, sorry, the other way around. The unionists are the ones that call it Derry, the traditional ones that want to go back to Irish rule, and the unionists, the ones that want to be part of the United Kingdom, call it Londonderry. And whatever it is that you call that town when you're in Ireland tells everybody which side of the debate you're on. And you cannot avoid picking sides. So if you say I'm going to Derry, then you're the Irish nationalist, right? You're on that side. And if you call it Londonderry, then you're part of the Great Britain side, and you're making a stand for that side. And you can't get around it. So where are you going today, love? Well, I'm going to Londonderry. So declared it. And when you're having a conversation with someone that lives there, whatever you call that city tells everybody which side of the argument you're on. And trust me, it's an argument, as you can see from the sign. And a journalist came up with a really cool way of overcoming the debate. He was a journalist, and he's writing for a local newspaper. And so he called the town Derry/Londonderry. And kind of got both of them at the same time. And all of the people that are picking sides are going, you can't do that. You got to choose the sides, right? And in a sense, what I'm talking about today is the ability to live in the slash. I'm the slash. I'm that piece that is not picking sides, that is figuring out life of how do we live the gap. Right? And it's not easy to do, by the way. It's not easy to be content. It's not easy to be okay with what I have. Right? That's a toughie, if we get really honest about it. And there's an interesting little scripture in Matthew 6. Do you want to bring that up, Chantel, the Matthew 6 quote there? Not to worry, the worry one. That's the one. You got that? And it's, there you go. And it says this, says that, has anyone by fussing in front of a mirror ever gotten taller by so much as an inch? That's a rhetorical question, by the way. Unless you're wondering. That's not something the Bible's suggesting that you do, stand in front of a mirror and try and stretch yourself out. All this time and money wasted on fashion, do you think it makes that much difference? Instead of looking at the fashions, walk out into the fields and look at the wildflowers. They never primp or shop, but have you ever seen color and design quite like it? So this idea of being okay with where you're at. Now, I think when we look into the mirror, so here's a picture of how women see themselves in a mirror. That's a female way of seeing themselves. And of kind of body image. They asked 200 women to describe their body, and every single one of them said something negative. Now, men, on the other hand, this is how they see themselves. In total delusion. Okay, let's get out of there. But the idea is being okay with where you are. Right? I mean, think about the stuff we don't have that we would like, that gap, that space that gets us there. And I think a lot of the spiritual life revolves around how we live the slash, how we live that gap. How do we enter into being content in that? I really liked the meditation this morning because it was a sense in which that contemplation is being okay. And if you're not okay, being okay with the fact that you're not okay. And when you don't have what it is that you want, being okay with that. Not to say that you stop desiring that, because the idea of having what you want, right, or desiring what you want, that motivates. It's there. It's part of life. Getting what you want has a whole set of its own challenges. When you get what you actually want, right? Think about the single person who's 35 and still single, and I need to be married. And I'm single, and I got all of these single problems. And then you meet someone, and now you're 36 and you're married, and you traded your single problems for marriage problems. That's all that happened, right? In some ways, how many of you know single problems are a little easier to deal with? Because just you, right? So it's getting what you want has a whole set of circumstances around that can upset that, right? Now, when it comes to our spiritual life and our spiritual journey, it's interesting, and I've been thinking a lot about this idea of really wanting to get clear and to get certain about this idea of spirituality. I've been really struck with that thought. That in the spiritual journey, we move, I think, from the idea of being certain to on a journey where you end up being more uncertain than you are certain. Right? Now, I don't know about you, but in my journey, I was looking for certainty. Right? I grew up as a very insecure, came from a broken home, left England when I was 15, came to Canada, and I was really, really looking for certainty. And I remember, as a young adult, my conversion experience was a conversion from this searching to certainty. Right? It was like, yes, this is the way. Yes, this is going to do it. Okay, I got it. Right? And then you get what you want, and then in that certainty, there is a certain unraveling that begins to take place. Some of it happens quickly, some of it happens slowly, but for sure, my journey was definitely this unraveling of all the stuff that I'd figured out. So I begin to think about this. Why do we have this need, this desire for certainty? Right? What is that about? So think about the idea that when we're insecure, what does the insecure want? Certainty. It's really obvious. If you were to do a biographical study on, let's say, for example, John Calvin. Now, you can't find a theological perspective, right, of something that's more certain, right? So just bring up there, Chantel. So Calvin, excuse the joke on that. I couldn't resist free willy. But Calvin has this whole idea of total depravity, like everybody is broken, right? And there's this sense in which that you go from total depravity to unconditional election. Only a few are chosen. Right? And then you go to this limited atonement. In other words, the forgiveness is only for a certain few. And then you've got this irresistible grace that if you are chosen, you have no choice about it. And then the perseverance of the saints, you are going to make it right through to the end. Now, you can't find a more certain theology than that. You can't. And at the end of that, you're going, where did that come from? So I went back and I began to look at that from a psychoanalytical perspective and began to look at Calvin's journey and his broken home and all the stuff that he went through. He was 26 when he wrote this, the Institutes. And he was, by his own confession, a very insecure person. And so out of your insecurity, you write certainty. And in the early 1500s, what were people looking for? They were looking for certainty, theologically. And if you go back through church history, you've got this incredible journey where people are looking, hear my language here, they're looking to get their theology right. They're looking to nail it down. 1500s, and the Germans are great by this. If you're of German heritage, God bless you. But the Germans love to organize things. Right? Yeah, you've been doing it. It's just like everything's just so. They're great at like building cars, like, you know, BMW, say that. I mean, they're great at doing the engineering stuff of life. And so when it comes to theology, and then you do, and listen to the term, listen to this, systematic theology. Like, who came up with this? Right? I remember being in school and studying this, say, okay, now we're going to study systematic theology. So let me reinterpret that. Let's organize our beliefs around God just so we can nail it and get it right. And if you look through 2,000 years of church history, it's always been an emphasis on getting it right. Who's in? Who's out? Who agrees? Who disagrees? What am I certain about? What can I know for sure? And then we communicate it as though we know it for sure. And that gives the masses the sense of, okay, we got this. Yeah, that sounded really certain. Right? And our language betrays the fact of all the uncertainty that's underneath. And one of the things I appreciate about friends here is it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to not be certain. It's okay to be working this out. It's okay to have more questions than you do answers. And one of the things that really struck me as I was looking at this, possibly there's another way of approaching our thinking around theology or around spirituality, and maybe a philosophical approach might be better. Theologians, by their nature, are trying to get it right, and philosophers are not. Philosophy comes from two words, phileo, which means to love, right? It's that sense of love and passion, right? And sophia, which is wisdom, to love wisdom. And good philosophy, someone writes a paper and they invite criticism. They invite people to read and critique what has been written. And so now, instead of just being right, you're looking at someone, so it gets written, and then someone adds to what's been written. I was listening to one philosopher a couple of weeks ago, and he said, our whole way of thinking came into being after it was critiqued. In other words, till that time, it was just in my head. Then I wrote it down, and people started critiquing it, and then it took on a form and a shape of its own. And continues to take on form. And so when you listen to philosophy, you get people quoting other philosophers and adding to that. Why? Because they love wisdom. There is this phileo and sophia that they're passionate about and they love. And when you love wisdom, it's not about arriving at a destination and getting it right. It's about the love of learning. It's about the passion to understand. And I don't know about you, but my journey has, the understanding of the spiritual life has changed in the last couple of minutes. You see what I mean? It's like we are always unfolding and growing in our understanding. And when we have the context into which we can share that growth, we can share that love, we can share that sense of understanding and our sophia, our wisdom with one another, then we're able to grow. Now, from a psychoanalytical perspective, here's what gets in the way of that, is that when we are functioning out of uncertainty and out of insecurity, right, and we're looking for that certainty, then we will trade, listen carefully, we will trade the passion and the love of learning for that which feels certain. We trade it off. I was invited a couple weeks ago to go up to Blueberry First Nation up in Treaty 8, and it's up about 102 miles on the Alaska Highway. And I was invited to go up there and do a parenting seminar. Now, my view of parenting is that God always gives us one really wacky kid just so that you won't write a parenting book. So I am not an expert on parenting. My stepson's here, so I got to be careful what I say. But you know, I've raised two girls, and I'm going to be a grandfather this fall. Yeah. Woo-hoo. So, you know, that's awesome. Like I think that success in parenting is getting them out of the house at 18. I think that's success. Like that's, you know, if they're alive and well out by 18, that's good. That's a good investment of $300,000. But when I was going out to Blueberry doing this, and I was trying to figure out how do I make this idea of parenting simple. It's always the challenge is to take something which, you know, the more I read on it, the more complicated it got. And I kept looking for simplicity and simplicity. So I took all this body of knowledge and then kind of reduced it down. I went, here you go. Here's three, if you like, principles of parenting that I think work. First one was that children all need to be seen as unique beings. Right? They need to be seen as unique beings. Now, I don't know, but like I'm 64. Anybody else in my generation, you were raised on this, little kids should be seen but not heard? Yeah. No, you weren't seen at all. Right? And oftentimes we put our perspective on what our kids should do. And we actually live vicariously through them. And we've got, you know, God loves your children and you have a wonderful plan for their life. Hello? Come on, parents. Like, don't we? We have a track that we think our kids should go on, right? Rather than seeing them as unique human beings and their uniqueness and seeing them, right? And when we love our children, love helps us see, right? Can't see love, but love helps you see. And so there's that place where you see your child as unique. And then we actually listen to them. Novel thought, right? You listen to your kids. They have a voice. And when the children have a voice, right? And we don't put them down and say, that's stupid, that's dumb, you shouldn't say that, that's this, or whatever. And all of the very benign comments that we can make as parents, right, that actually silence the voice. Okay? And the third parenting principle is that they matter. Their opinion matters. They are valuable. So I did all that parenting stuff, and I reduced it down to those three and basically taught out of those three principles for the day that I was there. There was a lot more to it, but that was, if you like, the reduction of the whole course in 3 points. So here's how it relates to today. When I thought of those 3 points and I thought about how I was raised, that was I seen for who I was? And I have to be honest with you, the answer to that was no. I did not feel... And again, I don't want to make my parents out to be wrong or bad. They weren't. They were functioning out of their perspective of life. And, you know, they were part of the silent generation. And, you know, they were just busy living life, right? Doing it the way that they would. And I was raised in England. And the English culture is, you know, all proper and stiff upper lip and all that kind of stuff. And so I didn't really feel seen, right? My dad was a musician and he loved music and I loved sports. All I wanted to have was a soccer ball and go over the park and play sports. And my dad, I think, and my entire recollection came to one soccer game. Right? Because that was not what he thought I should be doing. Right? And my mom didn't see anything in terms of what I was capable of or who I was. And it's interesting, my chosen career was to be a pastor. And I happened to be, and it's a good idea that you're a theist. If you're a pastor, you actually believe in God. It was a good idea back then. And So my mom's an atheist and very, very left wing. So it's like she didn't see me at all. Like there was no seeing that happened and there was no listening that happened. And so I grew up not being seen, not being heard. And it didn't matter. That what happened in our home, it wasn't about me. It was about what was good for my mom and dad and everything else and every other factor, but not about me. So I grew up feeling super insecure. When I saw this, I went, whoa. Because I don't know about you, but I went back to my conversion experience, when I was 21 years old. And I look at that experience today through very different lenses. My conversion experience was a very insecure 21-year-old that had just gotten out of drug rehab that was looking for certainty. And the best believable story came along, and I jumped on that with everything I had because it was certain. And I spent the next 25 years unraveling that certainty and trying to live that out in life. And I look back on that and I go, oh my goodness, how much energy did I waste trying to be certain and trying to be right? If I had just lived life that is not certain, right? I mean, if we did a survey of this community right now, how many of you know there would be a whole bunch of us that are going through stuff right now, right? We're going through stuff, right? There's things that take place in us, and we may not have answers for it. There may be a whole bunch of uncertainty that's going on for us. When you think of the typical 20-year-old, 20-something-year-old, right? And you ask them, great question. They love it when you ask this. What do you want to be when you grow up? They got no flipping idea. None of them. And so what happens is when you find another one that has no idea, you go, oh, thank goodness. You don't know either? That's so cool, because I don't know. And they think if you go to university, you're going to figure it out. Nope. How many people here have been to university and I didn't answer the question for you? Right? The big questions of life. Didn't answer them, right? Okay, I know what I need to do. I need to go get my master's degree. That'll fix it for sure. And how many people graduate kind of post-grad work? Still don't have a clue. Think about it. I remember there was a lovely young lady. She went to optometry school, which, I don't know, it's what, 7 years of school. And she got to the end of optometry school, and she said, I realized that I didn't want to be an optometrist. I don't know about you, but that's a little slow on the updraft on that one. Right? I go, what do you mean you don't want to be an optometrist? She said, well, my passion was around kids. I said, I should have been a teacher. I said, no. I said, you are where you are. I said, what if, possibility here, what if you did like glasses and, you know, eyewear for children? The thought had never hit her. She went, oh. So what a good idea. And she moved back home, went back to Saskatoon. She opened up an optometry shop for kids. And now she gets to live out of her passion. But we do. We kind of go through life not knowing and thinking that one more something is going to figure it out for us. You know, I should be here. Now, here's the fun piece. When you get to my age, right, I still haven't figured it out. First off, I don't think I've grown up. And second off, I haven't got a clue what I want to do. You with me? We do what's there. We walk through the doors that are opening for us, and we live in that gap and in that space. Now, I want to leave you with a thought. Question. What is your relationship right now with space? What is your relationship with emptiness? Because think about it. There's more emptiness and space in life than there is stuff. Take this room right now. This room, there's a whole bunch of us in this room and a whole bunch of stuff in this room, but there's way more space than there is stuff. Right? Not yet. Give me some view. Yeah. Okay, good. All right. And if you look at an atom, what is an atom? An atom is made up of molecules and protons and neutrons and quarks, all kinds of particles in there, and a whole bunch of space. As a matter of fact, there's more space in an atom than there is stuff. Then we look into a telescope, and we look into the universe, and we can see millions of stars and planets and moons and stuff that's out there. But what's mostly out there is what? What do we call it? Outer space. Right? There is an emptiness in life that, let's be honest about it, we struggle with emptiness. We struggle with meaninglessness. We want to make stuff up to make things make sense. I'm intrigued by the fact, especially if you're a literalist, which I'm not, but if you read the Bible, it's interesting that in Ecclesiastes says 36 times that life is empty and meaningless. Hello. Now, I've read every commentary there is on this. It doesn't say if you do something wrong, it's empty and meaningless. Here's the wisest man on the planet, Solomon, and he's going, I've had it all. Everything I wanted, anything I desired. I've worked hard, and I look at it, and it's meaningless. It's empty. What a happy thought for the day. Right? Because we try to make sense of life. We are by nature meaning-making machines. And we're using up all of that energy. Here's a possibility. Here's another way of living in that space, in that emptiness, or that relationship with space and emptiness. What if we live it? What if we genuinely lived into the gap in loving, caring ways? When the door opens, we walk through those doors. Mother Teresa said this. She said, there are no great things in this life. There are no great things. They're just small things done with great love. And here's our lives. I don't know about you, but my life is filled with small stuff. Right? And when we do the small stuff with great love, that creates a way of being and a relationship with them. Because at the end of the day, if we don't have love, well, you're just a clanging cymbal and it's empty. And so, question. And the meditation today said this. Do you genuinely love yourself? Because that's where it starts. Can we genuinely have an amazing love affair with ourselves first? Like, how many of you woke up this morning and you looked in the mirror and you went, oh, you are so beautiful. You are freaking brilliant. Oh, you're awesome. And then you turned to your partner and said, babe, you're awesome. Because it came out of your own awesomeness. Try that sometime. Because if you start your day that way and you love yourself in the small things, like all the little odd things about you. And oh my goodness, if you don't think God has a sense of humor, you should come stand up here and look at you. Like, we're just weird, all of us. We got our bumps that are, you know, we got all kinds of stuff about us. But love that. Love that about you. Love where you are right now. But you tell them you don't get it. My life is right now a mess. I would love the mess. Love your mess. Love yourself. Stop wanting your life to be different. Here's the deal. Master the art of being with life as it is and isn't. And live into the gap. Live into that space. And do so in a loving, caring way for yourself and for those around you. Wouldn't that be cool? Okay, I'm done. You're good.